This episode of Wasteland may contain mature themes, profanity, and descriptions of sex, graphic violence, and criminal activity. Listener discretion is advised. April 27th, 1973, Main Street, Daytona Beach, Florida. 17-year-old Ross Michael Cochran was troubled. As he made his way through the just-awakening Main Street morning, he had time to think about what happened to him the previous night. Just outside the Boardwalk Arcade where he worked, he had been suddenly jumped by a former classmate, Kenneth Francis, also 17. The other boy had accosted him just outside and angrily chased him down the beach, striking Ross several times. Ross, who liked to go by Mike, wasn't much of a fighter. He took the beating and then took the advice of his attacker to, quote, go on. Ken didn't look right anyway. He was probably high, as he often was, so Mike left. Ken and his group of friends always seemed to have it out for him. They just didn't like him. Mike had an idea why, but even if it wasn't about that bad business at the school, they simply didn't need much of an excuse to pick on him. Though his original destination is now lost to time, that morning, Mike was probably headed back to the boarding house that he'd been living at for the last 2 weeks, just a block south of Main on Coates Street. Mike was rooming with landlady Delphine Guillemette's son, George, and the two had hit it off admirably. Hitting it off with someone wasn't always easy for Mike. Originally from Fresno, California, Mike had relocated to Central Florida when he was about 16 years old. His family was concerned with the boy's difficult emotional state. Coupled with an unidentified learning disability, Mike's family had seen fit to enroll him in the Green Valley School, an institution for troubled youth. The school was in Orange City, about a 40-minute drive west from Daytona's beachside. But George Guillemette seemed to like him well enough, even though Mike often appeared a little lost and disturbed, possibly due to being so far away from his family. Of course, Ken Francis and his group of friends didn't share this same agreeable attitude toward Mike. They accosted him every chance they got. So it's odd that as Mike headed down Main Street, rather than turning south and heading home to the Coates Street boarding house, he instead walked in the opposite direction, arriving at 27 North Grandview Avenue, at around 10:30 that morning. Differing accounts say he ran into some acquaintances and followed them, or perhaps was lured by them, while others aren't so specific. Regardless of how or why he wound up where he did, the result was, unfortunately, the same. 27 North Grandview Avenue was coincidentally also a boarding house, though the locals had another name for it, Roach Haven. Roach Haven was regarded as a place to flop, a drug pad, a squalid place where narcotics could sometimes be purchased, but always indulged in. The two-story building stood in a notorious area of Daytona Beach, which still isn't what one would call a nice place. Daytona's beachside, especially the blocks surrounding Main Street and the boardwalk, has always had a seedy reputation. Though frequented by tourists for a few months a year, in the off-season, this area of Daytona is regarded as an underbelly of sorts, one where drugs, prostitution, and crime aren't uncommon. Attempts to restore and rejuvenate the area have been largely unsuccessful thus far, and it was even worse in the 1970s. Beyond the neighborhood's bad reputation, there were also the rumors of what went on down in the basement of the Grandview House, that a group of kids conducted rituals down there and were involved in black magic and Satanism. It was neither a comfortable nor an inviting place as far as Mike was concerned. But despite the house's unsavory reputation, that morning Mike found himself on the front stoop. He was led in and headed upstairs to the second floor apartment, which was where Ken Francis, surrounded by several of his friends, was just shaking off an acid trip. Having regained some semblance of normalcy, Ken instantly recognized Mike. And at that moment, Mike knew he had made a grave mistake coming to Roach Haven that morning. I discovered the case of Ross Michael Cochran in the most unlikely of ways. Specifically, my mom told me about it. And my mom doesn't usually discuss things of a darker nature like this. Truth be told, she gets upset with me if I bring up anything morbid. And growing up playing in punk rock and metal bands, mainlining a constant stream of horror movies, and overdosing on true crime books, she was often quite upset with me. Still, when I mentioned that I was mulling over topics for another season of this infrequently updated podcast, and she said something about the witchcraft murder, I stopped in my tracks. Of course, she didn't know all the details, just a few of the more sensational ones. After all, the crime took place in the early 1970s when she was only a teenager. She'd been living in Florida for only a few years after moving down from Connecticut, and was preoccupied with finishing high school and meeting my dad. When I asked her why she'd never mentioned it to me before, she said it was just too terrible to talk about. With that glowing endorsement and a provocative name like the Witchcraft Murder, I started digging immediately. And just as quickly, Google returned to me a single article from a small out-of-state newspaper. Basic details, nothing more. There was nothing else of any substantial value. No Wikipedia, no Murderpedia, no article from a larger publication, no podcasts, no YouTube videos of questionable quality. There was almost nothing, which was a problem. I'm not a reporter. Sure, I've done a little freelance journalism. I've written 2 books. And aside from this show, I put most of my creative energy into the other podcast I do with my best friend called I Don't Want to Hear It. New episodes every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts. I didn't have any immediate means to acquire information, nothing on the internet and no sources I could contact, and I certainly didn't have the means to hire a private investigator. Not that the situation even warranted that. So I turned to the only resource that was available to me. The public library. I'll admit, my inner rust coal started to come to the surface when I sat down at the microfiche machine. I knew roughly when the crime had occurred, so I asked the librarian for the corresponding roll from the local papers of the day. I started shuttling back through time and instantly felt like I was uncovering some hidden conspiracy, some sort of esoteric crime that had been lost to time. Then, after about 10 minutes, the librarian came back and informed me everything was now online in a freely accessible news archive that I could access from home. I didn't need to feverishly work the microfiche machine in a darkened corner of the library. I could search from the comfort of my apartment. Feeling a little let down that I wouldn't have my Detective Somerset moment, I returned home and spent the next 8 hours clipping articles from the early 60s through the 1990s. And that was only the first day. Soon there were notebooks and binders filled with printed articles and court transcripts piled on my kitchen table. I bought highlighters and dividers. When things became unwieldy, I bought a corkboard. Certain names kept popping up, so I decided to attempt contacting a few of them. I managed to meet with a prominent attorney involved in the case only a week into my research. He seemed as surprised as I did that he actually took the meeting, but I found out, unfortunately, I was in possession of about as much information as he was. He hinted that he had a treasure trove of material on the case somewhere in his garage. It never surfaced. I went to the DeLand courthouse where the case had been tried and asked a clerk if I could see the case files, arrest reports, anything they had on it. They went into a back room and returned with an old, worn, handwritten ledger. "Anything from 50 years ago has been destroyed for a while now," the clerk said. "This is all that's left." That ledger had a list of arrested suspects and nothing else, which was information I already had. I emailed the uncle of the victim in this case. I came across his email connected to a family tree I found on the Internet Archive. He corresponded with me for a bit, but he assured me the immediate family would not be open to speaking about the crime. At any rate, I didn't have their contact information, so it was a dead end. A friend put me in contact with a former Main Street business owner, whose shop was once located right around the corner from the scene of this now 50-year-old crime. The conversation never really got past the trivial stage, though he assured me, after he'd had some time to think, we talked the following week. And after repeated calls, texts, and voicemails, he never answered me again. I even discovered that a pivotal character in the background of this case was a friend of my uncle, and he was incarcerated about 20 minutes from my home. Not being allowed to simply stop by for a visit without prior approval, I wrote to him twice. He never responded. My uncle and I don't get along at all, so going through him wasn't an option either. With all this resistance, it would have been very easy for me to assume that I was brushing up against a darkness that didn't want to be illuminated. Admittedly, I've consumed enough documentaries and podcasts about cults and conspiracies, and the words cult and witchcraft certainly dominated the early news stories about this case. But I soon realized, even despite the sprawl of the case as I would eventually understand it, there simply was no real secret here. Nothing had been hidden, at least intentionally. The simple fact was that everybody had forgotten. The ones that hadn't weren't reluctant to speak with me for any particular reason. They just didn't seem to care anymore. And with such a huge gap of time, most of the people involved in the events of this case are dead. I do think I know why Ross Michael Cochran was murdered. And you'll hear that theory with some evidence to support it eventually. But it's still just a theory. There isn't a mystery to solve here. Which is fine, because I've never been good at solving mysteries or decoding puzzles. One thing I am good at is telling stories. And no one's told this one yet. As of this recording, it's been 50 years since that day in late April of 1973 when Ross Michael Cochran arrived at 27 North Grandview Avenue. What awaited him in the upstairs apartment was a group of young people close to his age, give or take a few years, who reportedly lived their lives on Daytona's fringes. In a Daytona Beach Morning Journal article from May 3, 1973, Daytona Beach Police Detective F.W. Perrin referred to the transient residents of Roach Haven as, quote, drifters who frequently use marijuana and LSD. He said, these kids roam from place to place and live off a loaf of bread and a package of bologna. Consequently, with this revolving door of young wanderers staying at the Grandview house, details of who exactly was present for the crime and what unequivocally happened remain a bit hazy and nebulous, much like the mindsets of the young perpetrators. What is known is that Mike Cochran entered a room where he was not welcome that morning. During the initial investigation, the prevailing theory was that the residents of Roach Haven believed Mike was a narc who was working for the Daytona Beach Police Department. And for someone with Ken Francis's temperament, that was enough. Ken Francis arrived in Florida after living on the Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. His father, Paul, was a master sergeant in the Air Force and had, reportedly, been dealing with his son's hyperactivity and impulsiveness since the first grade. In a DeLand Sun article from December of 1973, Paul characterized his son as impatient. He said, he might pick up something and throw it across the room. He took out his frustrations at the moment, and then it would be over with. He used to get very upset with himself. Ken also suffered a skull fracture in 1966 and became noticeably more impulsive after the injury. Like Mike Cochran, Ken Francis had also been a student at the Green Valley School for Emotionally Disturbed Youths. In that same DeLand Sun article, the Reverend George Von Hilsheimer, the headmaster of Green Valley, described Ken as a bright kid who can't follow through. Von Hilsheimer said, he has a strong sense of moral righteousness. He respects, needs, and follows authority. He seems to have a desire to be brought under control. I'd call him a psychopathic truth teller. He's a kid who lays it out as it is. Certainly, Ken's impetuous nature, his shoulder-length black hair, scraggly mustache, and beard stubble didn't endear him to his presumably straight-laced and conservative military father. But Ken seemed right at home on the underside of the world's most famous beach. And with his temper, it's understandable that Mike Cochran wouldn't want to run afoul of him, especially after their recent encounters. But Ken wasn't the only young person present in the upstairs apartment at Roach Haven that April 27th. In fact, a good number of names were put forth during the investigation, none of which had been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt to have actually been present or to have participated in what occurred. However, it's generally accepted that besides Ken Francis, also present were Nick Frazee, 22, his wife Deborah Ann Shook, also 22, and David Hester, 17. Nick Frazee was staying at the Grandview House, but originally he hailed from Dayton, Ohio. Nick had only met Deborah Shook in March of 1973. The two married on April 25th, only 2 days before Mike came to the house, though the swiftness of their union wasn't the strangest thing about it. In an article from May 2nd, 1973, Nick told the Daytona Beach Evening Journal that he and Deborah had wed in a, quote, witchcraft ceremony. Nick said that he and Deborah shared an interest in witchcraft and demonology, and it was this commonality that brought them together. He described the wedding as a ritual of sorts, where the participants cut their abdomens and then were showered with wedding stones. And in the article, Nick is described as having a cut on his stomach. Nick also referred to the people living at the Grandview House as a coven requiring, quote, a denouncement of God and everything he stands for to become a member. These adherents allegedly had to sign their names in blood to gain membership. Nick maintained that there was a ledger of these blood signatures, but that he himself had signed some other document. The ledger was never produced. Deborah Shook was originally from Washington, New Jersey, where she had racked up a handful of petty arrests for things like glue sniffing and possession of glue in 1971. In 1972, she had also been arrested for profanity and disorderly conduct in Daytona Beach. After drifting into the orbit around the Grandview House and the alleged cult that spent time there, Deborah claimed to have joined them and adopted the name Ladora. David Otis Hester found his way to the seedier side of Daytona after a difficult upbringing in Greenville, South Carolina. In a DeLand Sun article dated October 16, 1973, David is described as suffering brain damage in a difficult birth to strict Baptist parents. It was reported that this condition led him into drug addiction by the age of 8. According to the article, David's life was marked by 3 suicide attempts and numerous attempts at professional counseling. When these measures failed, much like the other occupants of 27 North Grandview Avenue, David floated into what the article refers to as the classless society of Main Street hippies, where they share their girls and pay with narcotics for their services. And at some point, according to his peers, David Hester was recognized as the high priest to the coven of 27 North Grandview Avenue. Strangely enough, it was reported in the News Journal that David Hester was actually a resident at Delphine Guillemette's Coat Street boarding house, where Mike Cochran also lived. There were others alleged to have been present that morning: Charles Page, 21, John Colbert, 18, Stephen Skaggs, 21, Howard Wallace, 19, and Cindy Black, 17. Certainly, this group could be considered transient youth of the type to dabble in drugs, which perhaps opened them to the possibility of dabbling in occult activity, if just for the sheer thrill of it. Just as there is no definitive record of who was present, there's likewise no concrete accounting of what exactly transpired when Mike Cochran entered the second floor apartment at the Grandview House. We'll never know everything that was said in those first few, probably tense moments, but almost every account lines up on what was done to Mike shortly after he arrived. First, he was beaten. This beating must have started in the living room, but then escalated when he was dragged into a bedroom. There, he was tied to a bed where the violence continued. It appears that multiple people entered this bedroom, one by one, to have their turn to hurt the teenager. Eventually, the beatings turned into what can only be described as torture, as Mike was stabbed with pieces of broken glass. This abuse continued into the afternoon. As bad as all this was, a part of Mike was probably relieved that he was still upstairs and hadn't been taken down into the basement, its macabre reputation being what it was. So it can be assumed that Mike did his best to resist his captors when they came into the bedroom around 3 p.m., untied him, and took him down to that very same basement. But it wouldn't be enough. The walls of the basement were spray-painted with various symbols, including an inverted cross. Several other symbols of various origin, some conflicting, i.e. satanic, Christian, and Wiccan, also adorned the room. But it was the altar that drew one's attention. A central fixture of the basement was a large workbench. At some point, The residents had painted it completely black, and it was, allegedly, used by the Grandview cult as a sacrificial altar. It was here that Mike was placed for the torture to continue. And it did. The beatings did not abate, and his captors graduated to whipping him with lengths of chain. Around 7 p.m., a semi-conscious, beaten and bleeding Ross Michael Cochran was removed from the basement of 27 North Grandview and placed into the trunk of a waiting car. Four people got into that car and drove away. Those four people were, allegedly, Ken Francis, Nick Frazee, Charles Page, and David Hester. The group drove west on Volusia Avenue until they picked up State Road 415 and headed south. Even today, this area is rural and quiet, but 50 years ago, it was desolate. It would have been between 45 minutes and an hour before the group finally stopped, parking the car on an isolated stretch of road. The foursome found themselves between the quiet inland towns of Osteen and Samsula in a heavily wooded area. And even at that time of early evening, around 9 or 10 o'clock, passing cars wouldn't have been a concern. Mike was removed from the car and bound more securely. Then he was carried into the woods. And it was here that Ross Michael Cochran's life came to a tragic and abrupt end. He was bludgeoned to death by his captors with a log, but not before a botched attempt was made to cut his throat. They left him there in a lonely patch of Floridian scrub brush next to an empty highway without dignity or ceremony. Mike's disappearance probably didn't go unnoticed, but his absence spurred no one to action. No one at the Guillemets boarding house reported him missing, and neither did his boss at the Boardwalk Arcade. With Roach Haven's dark reputation and the general unsavory atmosphere of Main Street, people may have been reluctant to speak to authorities. But there was talk. There were people in the neighborhood who had heard some version of what happened, and 5 nights later, one of them would break their silence. On the evening of May 1st, Daytona Beach police arrested a teenage car thief mid-break-in on Main Street. After his booking, seeing a chance to hopefully get out of jail for free, the would-be car thief requested to speak to a detective. He said, "I've got something to tell you." This episode of Wasteland was researched, written, produced, recorded, edited, and in some areas, scored by me, Michael Paul Anthony. If you'd like to contact the show, the email address is wastelandpodfl@gmail.com. I want to thank you for listening, and if you like what you heard, please share it with a friend. Until next time.